In the summer of 1978, residents of Love Canal, a suburban development in Niagara Falls, New York, began protesting against the leaking toxic waste dump in their midst. A 16-acre site containing 100,000 barrels of chemical waste that anchored their neighborhood. Initially seeking evacuation, area activists soon found that they were engaged in a far larger battle over the meaning of America's industrial past and its environmental future. The Love Canal protest movement inaugurated the era of grassroots environmentalism, spawning new anti-toxic laws as well as new models of ecological protest. Historian Richard Newman examines the Love Canal crisis through the area's broader landscape, detailing the way this ever-contentious region has been used, altered, and understood from the colonial era to the present day. The name of the book is Love Canal, A Toxic History from Colonial Times to the Present, and we welcome Richard Newman to the roundtable this morning. Richard, thank you very much for being with us.
Great to be with you.
Wonderful to have you on the program. What brought you to this particular subject?
Well, I was teaching environmental history at Rochester Institute of Technology, but I'm originally from Buffalo. Someone had asked me to tour Niagara Falls one time, and in the midst of that tour, a friend suggested that we try to find Love Canal, the famous human-made environmental disaster. And when we tried to find it, tourist representatives had diverted us to the area's industrial flats. And we eventually found the old and abandoned neighborhood, series of houses that had been bulldozed and a big chain link fence around this old toxic waste dump. And that got me to thinking about where the Love Canal landscape fit in the history of the region and the nation. And that was about 15 years ago, so I'm delighted that the book is finally out.
As I mentioned, the subtitle is A Toxic History from Colonial Times to the Present. So where did you want to start the story?
Originally, I wanted to start the story with the environmental disaster itself, and if people aren't familiar with it, as I find many younger readers and students are not, Love Canal began in the summer of 1978 when a group of residents complained about the leaking and toxic contents of a dump that their neighborhood was built around and in some cases literally on. And that eventually led to, after a long series of protest struggles, the evacuation of the neighborhood, the buyout of homes, and a whole series of laws relating to environmental history that we're now familiar with, like the Superfund hazardous cleanup law. So that's very well known to folks in environmental history, but as I started to research the toxic past of the region, I realized you had to go far back into time, beginning with the struggle over what the landscape would be when Native Americans confronted European and American explorers. It seems that from a very early stage of the area's development, people were trying to not only commercialize the land but change it. And I argue in the book that that's the first instance of a toxic past, and it leads sort of inevitably down the road to using the landscape as a big sponge for toxic waste that people think you can just throw away, forget about, and then through the magic of industry, pop a neighborhood down on top of it and move people in the 20th century.
And I guess that is the most surprising and unbelievable part of this story, that you have all of this stuff, this sponge, which is a great analogy, and then you put a neighborhood right on top of it. How does that even happen?
Well, a lot of it has to do with what didn't happen before neighborhood protests erupted and Love Canal became a watchword of environmental activism. Even in the wake of Earth Day and all the environmental protests of the 1960s and early 1970s, people were not really focusing in on the hazards of toxic waste in the 20th century. And a lot of that had to do with the fact that chemicals had produced a lot of wonders. So the cars that people drove, the televisions and radios that they listened to, so many of the wonders of American life relied on chemicals. And the chemical industry, which was very strong in Niagara Falls, had also provided a really wonderful style of life to area workers and their families. So in the 1960s and 70s, as this area is being built out, no one's really thinking about the toxic underside of industrialization or chemical life. But slowly and surely, Niagara Falls and Love Canal seep into people's consciousness because the chemicals don't just disappear. the Love Canal neighborhood becomes like an Area 51 of Niagara Falls, where people are convinced that there's something strange and haunted going on. And every time they tell the authorities come, investigate, and say, it's not really a big problem, we'll take care of it. Those problems grow worse, and eventually there's a series of health maladies related to living in the Love Canal neighborhood. They're documented by state health officials in 1978, and eventually in August of 1978, the state health department declares the neighborhood itself a health peril. But before that, people weren't really conscious of the impact of chemicals on the day-to-day lives of residents in anywhere USA. And so that's why Love Canal is really important.
You mentioned 1978 as a date, but go back even further than that when people started to complain that things just weren't right where they were living. Those complaints go back how far?
They go back to the beginning of the neighborhood itself. And the neighborhood itself, before it is a neighborhood of homes, and even before it's a toxic waste dump, it is going to be the bed of a hydroelectric power canal that a great industrialist in the 1890s named William Love is going to build around Niagara Falls. The landscape around the falls itself, which many people might be familiar with, is actually higher than the waterway. And if you could build an artificial river over that elevation, William Love thought, you could produce double the power of Niagara Falls. So he started digging out a canal bed, and then his plan went bust. And so he had this great groove of earth that filled with water. And as the chemical industry takes off in the early 20th century, they eventually locate that space as a wonderful, they believe, dumping grounds and mausoleum for toxic chemicals. For about 10 years in the 1940s, Hooker Chemical dumps about 100,000 barrels of toxic waste in that groove of earth, and by the early 1950s, they seal it up. But it's the baby boom era, and Niagara Falls is still growing, and the city school board needs land, so they purchase the land for a dollar. And as soon as they purchase it, they start building on it. They build a school, and the foundation of that school sinks into the chemical dump on which it's built. So you could say that the complaints and concerns begin as soon as the dump becomes a neighborhood. And then in the late 50s and early 60s, as houses are built and people move in, they start to notice strange and funky things. And by the 70s, these kinds of concerns and fears and strange occurrences are well known. I interviewed residents who remember getting chemical burns from picking up softballs in the outfield of baseball and softball diamonds around the school grounds. I talked to people who had chemical leachate seeping into their sump pumps and basements. I talked to people who remember going to friends' houses and having above-ground pools literally lifted up a couple of feet because chemical barrels had protruded. And the thing is, a lot of people just didn't believe these kinds of things could happen until they visited the landscape. And so only after they visited Love Canal at the bequest of residents did they realize it was a toxic environment.
And but again, you're looking at 1978 when the movement started and it started to get people together and have the community come together and complain about it. We were seeing those complaints come in the early 1970s where people really said, look, there's something dire here.
Right. And, you know, it's very much like the Flint lead crisis now. I see a lot of parallels. One important parallel is the idea that there's a problem that the community knows about that experts and politicians try to downplay. And so there was constant what politicians call constituent concern registered on the political radar, but it never made it above that level of initial complaint. People in political office heard about it, maybe at a very low administrative level they examined the Love Canal environment, but not until the mid-70s did they really start doing sophisticated scientific and environmental testing. And then by 1977, when the complaints kept coming, the state of New York did more health and environmental tests, and the federal government got involved. So the issue, though it blew up in the summer of 1978, had actually been around for several years. But the other thing that's important, just like in Flint, is that once health officials or political officials validate an environmental concern, it's important to recognize that the activists underneath have not only been mobilizing, but are going to continue to put the pressure on political, legal, and environmental officials. And that's why in the book, I really go to great lengths to say that we have to acknowledge the important role played by these neighborhood activists, many of whom had no inkling that they would become environmental activists, but events forced them to the public stage, and they realized that they had to become their own best advocates, keep complaining, keep protesting, keep organizing, because even after Love Canal was quote-unquote discovered, there was no evacuation, there was no massive cleanup planned. It was very contained and small, and only because of continued protest did we get things like Superfund.
The name of the book is Love Canal, A Toxic History from Colonial Times to the Present. Richard Newman is our guest and the author of the book. When it comes to the aftermath, and a lot of people said, okay, we are going to make sure this never happens again, which, of course, it has happened again. So where did we go right? Where did we go wrong? And what can we do in the future to really eradicate problems like this?
Well, the first thing that goes right, as I said before, is that the citizens themselves organize into a protest bloc, and that allows them to maintain solidarity and a sense of movement identity so that they can surmount all the political hurdles that they confront. One of the initial complaints levied against Love Canal protesters is that they're just self-interested and want to get moved out of a neighborhood that's not so great at government expense. And what the protesters do is they study environmental history, they study their environment, they create a whole series of counterarguments, including the argument that a lot of people really just take for granted today, but you couldn't then, which is that everyone has environmental rights, the right to a clean neighborhood, clean daily living spaces, clean school environments. And this addresses that urban and inner city core of environmentalism that a lot of classic environmentalists in the 20th century ignore in favor of, you know, wilderness preservation. So by introducing that discourse of environmental rights into environmentalism, Love Canal activists make a big difference. What they also do, and I think get right for the rest of America, is spawn a debate about polluted and toxic environments across American society. So just like in Flint, after Love Canal explodes as a public issue and activists start corresponding with people around the country, you get folks from California to Maine looking in their backyard and finding toxic trouble, and that leads to state environmental cleanup laws, that leads to not only Superfund, but federal right-to-know laws, which in the mid-1980s say that anyone in the neighborhood can approach an industry or a landfill to know what's being stored or incinerated in their neighborhood. So in that sense, there's a lot of good that comes out of the Love Canal movement. Those environmental cleanup laws like Superfund, they're very important because they identify the worst and most hazardous places in the American environment, and they set cleanup plans. So if you think about Love Canal, it was a corroded and polluted environment. And eventually that dump is largely, although there's still debate about this, contained. And if you multiply that by the hundreds around the country, there are other really problematic environments that were put on the cleanup map. Now, what did we get wrong since there? I think one of the things that we've noticed in the last decade or two is that it costs money to not only clean up the environment, but deal with toxic problems that were created in the past. So now we see throughout the Great Lakes, down in Louisiana, a lot of toxic neighborhoods that aren't even on the list of Superfund sites. And the question is, who's going to pay to clean that up? And Superfund itself has frequently run into money troubles and was not renewed in terms of funding by Congress in recent years. And the question is, what do you do next? So I think environmentalists keep pushing. Something like the Flint lead crisis creates another angle for examining toxic environments. But I think there's still a lot to do to convince the American people and American politicians that you have to continue the work that was started by Love Canal and other activists to clean up a toxic environment.
When you think about what is going on in Flint, we have a situation here in our region in Hoosick Falls. it seems so often that what it all goes back to is a government response and the quickness to that response. And I'm curious as to how many incidents like this is it going to take for there to be a very quick response and a protocol that comes in, and not to just say, okay, this one thing happened, we have to change everything, but to look at it over a reasonable period of time, whatever that is, and say, okay, we can stop this quickly.
That's a really interesting way of putting it, because it's exactly what the Love Canal protesters say about toxic waste in their Niagara Falls neighborhood. Even when some political or industry officials want to acknowledge that there was a problem in their daily living space, that acknowledgement would only be localized. So folks wouldn't acknowledge that across the chemical industry there was a problem with hazardous waste disposal. And in the lead water crisis, initially people didn't want to believe that this could be a national problem because it would cost too much money to clean up every neighborhood. So what Love Canal activists did is they focused on mobilizing people from the ground up. And Lois Gibbs, the most famous Love Canal activist, would always tell people, and she's still an environmental activist to this day, you need to hold on to your story. It's the most powerful thing you have. And that story is not simply about a polluted environment. It's about the roadblocks that were put in your way. It's about the steps that need to be taken to clean up this environment. It's about connecting the dots to other polluted environments. And so making sure that your region and the Albany area's lead problem is connected to a discussion about Flint, and that lots of people in communities around the country talk to state and federal officials about passing a national law or a series of state laws that would address these issues en masse would be a really important outcome, because on a dot-by-dot, problem-by-problem basis, you will never actually address the problem. You'll just be waiting for the next problem to occur. And I think that's really one of the great legacies of Love Canal. Even after these neighborhood activists are finally, at government expense, evacuated, and it took almost 2 years for that to happen, many of them remain activists. They speak to university students. They go on speaking tours. They write autobiographies. Here it is 30 years later, and they're still talking about not only their own environmental disaster and its importance in the 21st century, but what their experience can do to help other people who are just discovering environmental disasters. And so if folks in Albany and Flint become environmental activists or concerned citizens who want to change their environment, that will allow these problems not to be marginalized and rather fully addressed, so that they can be put on a political agenda, true solutions can be created, and people can feel like they're being proactive and not reactive to environmental problems.
The name of the book is Love Canal, A Toxic History from Colonial Times to the Present. It is published by Oxford. Richard Newman, a great pleasure. Thank you very much for being with us.
It's been a real pleasure to talk to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Again, the title of the book is Love Canal, A Toxic History from Colonial Times to the Present. The book is published by Oxford and written by Richard Newman. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.